Today at Reader's Corner, Mary Pilon, author of The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Those of us who grew up playing the board game Monopoly likely remember the thrill of landing on an up-for-grabs boardwalk or park place and buying the pricey properties with our stash of brightly colored fake money. We might also recall the feeling of trepidation when we landed on those same properties after they had been purchased and improved by someone else, knowing we would have to pay an exorbitant rental fee before we could once again pass go and collect our much-needed $200. But while Monopoly is embedded in our culture, it's likely that few, if any, of us have given much thought over the years to how this iconic board game came into being. In her New York Times bestseller, The Monopolist, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game, Mary Pilon delves into the intriguing history of Monopoly and the cast of characters that brought it to your dining room table. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Ms. Pilon. She is an award-winning journalist, primarily covering sports and business, and she joins us by Skype for this interview. Mary Pilon, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how many Monopoly games are out there? How many have ever been produced over time? Do we know that?
Oh, man, that's a great number. And I mean, I think it's safe to say millions. Parker Brothers started making the game in the mid-1930s. But prior to that, the people were making all these folk games. So they were making them, you know, at home. So it's hard to know from when the game was originally conceived in 1904 to today. And that's not even including all the other Opoly games, right? All the spinoffs, which today are made through a license with this company called USA Opoly. But I think it'd be impossible to count.
So when I used to play Scrabble, I had to get a board game and I had to get two or three or four friends. And now I've got two or three Scrabble games on my iPhone. And when I'm sitting around and don't have anything else to do, I can go and play Scrabble at the instant. Is there anything like that going on with Monopoly?
Hasbro does have digital versions of the game. I have it on my iPhone personally. The game has gone digital in all these other ways, which is something that's so fun about the games industry too, is that you have these older titles like Scrabble, Monopoly, and they're kind of being reborn online, especially with mobile. And the Monopoly iPhone game actually has a feature where you can shake it to roll the dice, which is quite fun.
So the history behind this game, which is really most of your book, trying to figure out who really gets the credit for this and who really put this thing together. Why don't we start with the commonly held history and the story of Charles Darrow, because that's about where you started it in your book.
Exactly. So for years, the story that I had heard and most people had heard was that Monopoly was invented during the Great Depression. The story was that in the mid-1930s, you know, Charles Darrow was this man living in Philadelphia. He was, you know, unemployed, trying to support his family, which was unfortunately the story for many people, you know, in the early 1930s. And he goes into his basement and innovates, and he creates this game. At first, Parker Brothers doesn't want it, but ultimately Darrow prevails. He sells it. It becomes this massive blockbuster. You know, he and Parker Brothers are saved from the brink of financial destruction. And it's a very, you know, kind of warm and fuzzy Horatio Alger rags to riches story.
Now, obviously, there's a lot more to the story than that. And part of the reason for the rest of the story is a woman by the name of Lizzie Maggie. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, Lizzie McGee. So it turns out that the Darrow story isn't exactly true. And in fact, the game originated with Lizzie McGee, this woman in 1904 who receives a patent for her game called the Landlord's Game. And the game was played by a who's who of left-wing America for at least 30 years before Darrow and the kind of more commonly told Monopoly story was out there, and long before Parker Brothers was even making the game. And Lizzie McGee, she died in 1948. She did not have any children. She had outlived her husband. She died pretty much in obscurity. I mean, nobody knew who she was or what her contribution to the creation of the game was.
Did you say that the who's who of left-wing America was playing the game?
Right. So Lizzie McGee, when she makes her game in 1904, she's an impassioned follower of Henry George, who's another name that a lot of people, you know, today don't know about, economists do. But the very boiled down version of Henry George is that he was very interested in something called a single tax. He was very concerned with how people were being taxed, the relationship of people, land, nature. And she makes her game, you know, as kind of a left-wing teaching tool. And board games, you know, at the turn of the century were very much used for education or teaching people morals. And I talk in the book a little bit about how Milton Bradley was one of the early pioneers of the kindergarten movement in the United States, and that the original Game of Life, which long predates Monopoly, is actually quite dark. There's a suicide square. There's a matrimony square. Like, it deals with these kind of themes in a kind of more grim way. But he was very interested in education. So the idea that Lizzie McGee would take to a board game as a way of communicating her political ideas and trying to teach people about how things worked and income inequality, which was something she was very concerned with, isn't far-fetched. It seems strange to us today. So her game, you know, within this the circle of folks who are following Henry George, it gets passed around pretty quickly. It kind of goes viral, you know, early 1900s style. And it's played at Arden, Delaware, which is this single tax colony. And we know that Upton Sinclair went there. And it spreads, you know, especially among the Northeast and intellectuals. It's a big hit in college campuses. It's played in Boston. It's played in New York. And people just pass it from one to another the same way, you know, today when we talk about things going viral, we talk about sharing things with people via email or social media. That's what people did with this game. It was very much a folk game. And, you know, for years and years, that was the case.
So since Monopoly is a game about land, sum up for us the Henry George theory of land taxation.
So the really boiled down version is this idea that if you tax land and only land, it gives the working class a better shot at things. He was very concerned with the monopolists of his time. George died in the late 1800s, but you know, this was a time when there was an incredible amount of wealth being created in the United States that was concentrated among a few people. And a lot of people today still talk about, you know, the J.P. Morgans, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers. And he was really worried about what that would mean for the little guy trying to rise up. And you know, he was also very interested in this idea of what occurs in nature. So if you look at some of the more Georgist, you know, like Arden, Delaware, the colony I mentioned, there's always a large public square. There's an idea of park space and things that occur naturally. Everyone should enjoy the benefit of. And you know, he was a huge deal in his time. There are all these really incredible accounts of him, you know, packing out these halls for, he was a very charismatic speaker. His book, Progress and Poverty, was a bestseller in its time and inspired a lot of people, including Lizzie McGee. He actually ran for mayor of New York City and came in second behind a Tammany Hall candidate, but ahead of some Teddy Roosevelt guy. So he, whatever he was saying, you know, was really connecting with people at the time. And what's funny about reading his writing and some of the kind of musings of single taxers is a lot of the same jargon then we see in today's op-ed pages. How much should people be taxed? What is the relationship between, you know, kind of the quote unquote one percenters and those trying to economically go up the ladder? So, you know, here we are over a century later, and a lot of these themes are very much still with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I read the book and read the part about Henry George, I recalled from my earlier career in government and politics, I would run across people who were members of the George Society. This is back in Illinois. And it was an active group of people who were still trying to carry on Henry George's ideas. So just for the heck of it, I decided to Google Henry George to see what I come up with. And I come across an April 2015 article in The Economist, which I would consider slightly right of center, kind of a moderate magazine, but probably more conservative years ago than it is today. The name of the article is Why Henry George Had a Point. And I thought that was really fascinating that even today in a mainstream magazine like The Economist, you've got folks still paying homage to Henry George's ideas.
Absolutely. One of the fun things about the book was I went to the Henry George birthplace in Philadelphia to do some research. They were extremely helpful. And along the road for the book tour, you know, people have popped up who are still, you know, very interested in him, whether it's more on a political, you know, scale or more in terms of the academic side and kind of looking at his theories in context, you know, for that time period. But it is interesting. And I think that George also had a lot, like a lot of historical figures, has these other interesting ripple effects. And one of the things that a lot of Georgists will talk about is the other people who are very influenced by some of the conversations he was starting. Leo Tolstoy is a name that comes up a lot. And, you know, this was a time of uncertainty. And I think that he he was a very eloquent speaker, very eloquent writer. So he could boil a lot of these themes down in a way that was not just part of the political discourse of the time, but also resonated with people like Lizzie, who, you know, maybe hadn't gone to college, but were very intrigued and very curious about these things.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and today we're talking to Mary Pilon, the author of The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Again, if you could elaborate on the difference between Lizzie McGee's game, which really is, it's called the Landlord's Game, and as you point out, it has political purpose. But man, by the time Monopoly comes into play, it's about bankrupting your opponents. The last person standing wins. That's a far different political and economic philosophy than Lizzie McGee and Henry George had in mind.
Exactly. And there's a great irony, right, that this game started as a left-wing teaching tool, and yet most of us associate it now with money grabbing. And, you know, so when Lizzie McGee creates her game, she actually makes two rule sets. She makes a monopolist rule set and an anti-monopolist rule set. And it's the monopolist rule set that really starts taking off, which is really fascinating when you think about who's playing it. So maybe that's just inherent in our human nature, that when we're given the two options, we would rather clobber each other right. if we have the choice. And one of the reasons why the game is so great in the early 1930s, I think, is that it was effectively product tested for 30 years. So people tinkered with it and kind of took her original patent and her original thinking and modified it a little bit. One of the things that you still see today is that people, when they played the game, they localized it. So if you were playing it in Boston, you would put Boston properties on it. If you were playing it in New York, you'd put New York properties on it. So it became customized in a way that was pretty neat. And one of the groups that really embraces the game are the Quakers of Atlantic City. And they, of course, put Atlantic City properties on it. And one of the things that they had done, too, is they simplified the game. A lot of Quaker teachers were playing it. So they did things that, you know, made it more palatable to children. One thing that they also did that I found totally fascinating is, you know, silence is a big part of the Quaker faith. And the original versions of Monopoly had a lot more auctioning of properties, and they reduced the role of auctioning and they put in fixed prices because they don't like the noise associated with it. And it's fascinating that the Quaker version of the game ends up being the one that Darrow is taught by a friend and then sells to Parker Brothers. But the Atlantic City pieces are because of the Quaker school teachers. Part of the Darrow myth that was retold for years is that he would say, I put the Atlantic City properties on, or my family have better times vacationing there. But actually, it's much more complicated, and that it was inspired by people who were actually living on the streets of Atlantic City, which, if you're a fan of Boardwalk Empire, you know, was probably a pretty great place to be at the time. And it was very much a melting pot in and of itself, and that the cartography of that board ended up being this interesting window into race, class, religion, and how Atlantic City was functioning at the time.
One of the things that really never occurred to me, and I guess it's because we take for granted that the games we played as kids probably came into existence when we were kids. I didn't understand that you can take this one, and I wasn't a kid at the turn of the 20th century, although I may be old. I'm not that old. This game goes all the way back to the turn of the 20th century. How popular were board games in those days?
Board games were really huge. And there are some reasons for why that is that have nothing to do with the game industry. Although George Parker and Milton Bradley certainly were pioneers and kind of seeing the commercial appeal of these things. But there are all these things that you don't even think about, really. Things like expansion of indoor lighting, or leisure time. The fact that the working class was going to be able to have time to play these games, and especially at night. Games go back as old as humans are, basically. I mean, there's something in our nature, I think, that makes them really powerful tools. But at the turn of the century, you really do see kind of, you know, George Parker and Milton Bradley, Parker is a great example. He started his company as a teenager in New England, and it just becomes huge, and it grows and grows and grows. And then after World War II, you have another interesting kind of era of board games, which is that everybody was having babies. I mean, you have now families. You have the demographics of this country changing in a way that are greatly beneficial to toy and game manufacturers. And now if you look at the video game industry, which is something I'm very interested in, I mean, the numbers are staggering. I feel like people have very much moved with their feet in terms of appreciating, you know, games, whether that's you know, on a Wii or on their phone or what have you. So there is something, I think, you know, board games, and you can look at the history of board games and look at today's game culture, and there's seeds of it planted all over. Yeah, so they became really popular with the masses. And I think Monopoly, it's important to remember that when it comes to commercially sold games, there hadn't really ever been anything like Monopoly before. I mean, nobody knew that they were sitting on a hit game, because a hit game is really difficult then and now, let alone something that would be taught from one generation to another. That's really unusual. So none of us, thankfully, none of us are as old as the game.
So let's talk about the Depression. The Monopoly served an important purpose, in a sense, in the Depression as well, didn't it?
Yes. You know, the game had been around a long time before. And the Darrow story, even if it's not true, is interesting because it becomes part of Depression era lore. And it was the first time, really, that a game maker, you know, games aren't like books in the sense that with books, you know about the author, you go see a film, for example, because of a certain star or maybe even a director. But board game makers were more or less anonymous. You knew who George Parker was, who was kind of the publisher of these games. But the Darrow story, I think one of the reasons why it stuck with us all this time, even though it's not exactly true, is that it's a really romantic story. And one of the things about Monopoly that is also ironic is that people didn't think that in the 1930s, people would want to play a game that involved real estate, handling money, things that obviously were really stressful and difficult during the Great Depression for people. But I think that it's an amazing example of how games are role-playing tools, and they give us a chance to do things often in a context that we can't do in real life. And I think the Monopoly, even though it had been around for a long time, we still associate it with the 30s, and it sold so well then at a time when very few things were, because it spoke to, I think, a greater psychological need that so many people felt at the time.
And apparently the colleges got into the act, the fraternities as well?
Yes, absolutely. It was played at a lot of fraternities, and that's actually how the Quakers ended up getting it. It was played all over the place, which is funny too when you think about it. I mean, part of game history that's lost is that when you think of games with dice or gambling, they seem so benign now. But the Quakers, and even in some fraternity circles, the idea of playing a game with dice was considered to be a little edgy, because dice were associated with gambling and chance and things that were, you know, perhaps a little nefarious. So at the time, I mean, it's crazy to think about Monopoly being edgy today, but at the time it very much was, which I think is part of the reason why maybe fraternities embraced it so much.
Well, part of your book is not really just about the game of Monopoly, but it's about this idea of stealing ideas and people who benefit from that. I had a tough time figuring out how you give credit to whom when it comes to the movement of an idea through time, and how any inventor or innovator is going to build on the ideas of the past, and where it's legitimate to say, yeah, you can do that, and where it's not. How do you draw that line in this case?
To be honest, I'm not 110% sure. And I hope that that's one of the reasons why I wanted to tell the story as a narrative kind of through these people, because I think it does get really, really complicated. But one of the takeaways for me was, I think the Darrow story, we love the light bulb effect. We love this idea that we could, you know, go invent something and it changes the world, and that, you know, just poof, it just happens. There's something very magical about that. And I think on some level, we love those stories because we want to think it could happen to us, right? I mean, it's like the equivalent of winning the lottery. But the truth about innovation and inventing is it's often a messy process. It often involves a lot of trial and error and unintended consequences and collaboration. I mean, the game, like we just talked about, you know, the Quakers made some tweaks to the game that I think helped make it what it is today. And in terms of who should get credit, you know, yes, Lizzie McGee, I mean, she had a patent, she renewed it. Her claim legally, you know, makes a lot of sense. But I think there's also something to be said for once you put something out there in the world, people are going to make it their own. So in the case of Monopoly, I do think it kind of makes you question all these things that are around us every day. And where do they come from? And how do they get there? And how does that work? I think those are all ideas worth exploring. And certainly with any invention, whether it's something really contemporary, you know, from Silicon Valley, or something older and more historic, I find myself much more skeptical about the origin stories than I ever have been. I mean, in tech, you always hear the garage myth. And, you know, how often that actually happens, you know, I think it often gets very overblown. Mm-hmm.
So why were the Quakers so angry with Charles Darrow over taking credit for the game?
So the Quakers, you know, they were in a frustrating position because they had played the game in the early 1930s before Parker Brothers. And then all of a sudden, Darrow starts being promoted as the inventor of the game. And they knew, because they had played it before him, that he hadn't invented it. They knew because they were there. But one of the frustrations that they experienced was that they also, at this point, weren't exactly sure who had invented it. And Quakers, you know, at the time were not really known for being litigious. They weren't interested in pursuing this in court, but they also, you know, usually when someone claims to have invented something and it's the original inventor that will speak out. And the Quakers knew that wasn't them because they had, you know, been taught the game. However, Lizzie McGee, you know, she's still alive in the 1930s when the, you know, Monopoly craze and the Darrow story is being told. And she does these two interviews, which are really remarkable, in the 1936, one with the Washington Evening Star, one with the Washington Post, where there's photos of her, you know, holding up her Monopoly boards and saying, hey, I created this game long before this guy showed up, long before Parker Brothers, but it just didn't get that much traction. People just didn't really follow up with it, you know, and the Quakers, you know, for years and years, and this comes out in these depositions, the anti-Monopoly case, talked about how people thought they were a little like eccentric for saying, oh no, the Monopoly story is not true. But they were frustrated because they just knew it wasn't true. And it was a story that was out there pretty extensively.
You're listening to Mary Pallon. She's the author of The Monopolist, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Before we leave Lizzie McGee, tell us about Lizzie McGee as a woman and as an innovator and as a character. She did some other things that were really strange, you might say.
So it turns out she is quite a character. And when I started looking into this, you know, I knew about the lawsuit that kind of exhumed the history. And I knew the Darrow story wasn't exactly true, but I was fascinated with who she was and how did this happen. I mean, at the time when she received her patent, fewer than 1% of patents were coming from women. And in fact, some officials would say, don't even bother applying because your patent could get rejected. So she was a very outspoken feminist, and she was very politically minded. Her father, James McGee, wasn't only an influential newspaper editor at the time. He was also he also knew Abraham Lincoln and had traveled with him during the Lincoln-Douglas debates in Illinois before he obviously became president. So she was in a context where she had a lot of access to ideas, justice, and she also was very, very brazen, you know, considering the times. She did this stunt where she placed an ad auctioning herself up to the highest bidder, likening how women were treated at the turn of the century to slavery. And she talks about, you know, how she feels like she should be earning more money and how the institution of marriage, you know, she takes a lot of issues with it, which this is before, you know, women had the right to vote. And here she is really putting her name out there, which and it shocked a lot of people. I mean, there were all these reactions to her and how eccentric she was. She had performed in plays. She wrote poetry. She wrote short stories. And what surviving work we have of hers, these themes of justice, female identity, they come up over and over and over again in a way that's pretty fascinating.
So let's talk a little bit about Ralph Ansbach. And I want to preface it by saying you mentioned early on that Lizzie created a version of Monopoly that was anti-Monopoly, and that later on in time brings up the work of the professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. And of course, also, he gets into the business of defending Lizzie. He wants to make sure that Lizzie McGee gets credit for Monopoly. Tell us how this whole story unfolds and what's Ralph doing these days?
Sure. So all the stuff that we've been talking about came about in a totally unlikely way. I mean, for decades, the history was buried, Lizzie McGee's role in it, as well as the early players of the game. So in the early 1970s, this economist named Ralph Ansbach, he wants to make a game that's a little bit more philosophically pleasing than Monopoly. He also is kind of left-wing in his politics. So he makes this game called Anti-Monopoly, and it isn't long before he hears from attorneys for Parker Brothers who say, you know, you can't make anti-monopoly. You don't have a claim to that. And that kicks off what ends up being a decade-long legal battle that goes to the steps of the Supreme Court, where in doing research for his case, Ralph unearths the true story and finds that Monopoly had this whole life long before Parker Brothers and becomes pretty consumed with trying to piece it all together. And he flies around the country taking depositions from these Quakers and these original players And remember, this is the 1970s, and he's trying to research people in the 20s and 30s, if not earlier. And he becomes kind of this Monopoly detective and pieces it all together. And at the risk of ruining the book, he ultimately prevails. And the court upholds his right to make his anti-Monopoly games. And then by the time I had come onto the story in about 2009, I reached out to Ralph on a whim because I was just trying to find out the true story about Monopoly. I was going to mention it in passing in a story. I was working at the Wall Street Journal, and he, you know, had known all this stuff for decades and is now retired. He lives in France. He splits his time in his, you know, 80s. It's pretty remarkable. And he had all these depositions, all these documents, all these photographs and things that ended up becoming a lot of the book. He cracked open the case, long before I had come along. But his story, as I kept reporting it and kind of the crazy episodes that he went through and putting it together, it became clear that that was going to be part of the story too. And that, you know, 40 years after the fact, that this unlikely character would be the one to piece together the Monopoly story. It ended up being totally crazy.
And what became of Lizzie after her years with Monopoly?
So unfortunately, you know, Lizzie McGee, as I mentioned, she passes away in 1948. Mm-hmm. She'd been working as a stenographer and a secretary in Washington, D.C. As far as we know, all she made off of Monopoly was about $500. And she didn't have any children. And her obituary at the time made no mention of her contribution to the game, to its history. So, you know, now what's been fascinating is since the book has come out, she is starting to get more credit. And there are people who are either contacting me or writing about it online or whatever, where she's becoming a character. She's becoming somebody in history that is being paid attention to, which, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting about reporting this is I think that history is full of Lizzie McGee's. It's full of these people that kind of chip away at the world and make it what it is and often go unnoticed. And so it's interesting to see long after she's passed that finally she's starting to get some credit.
And yet it's a bit sad or weird that here's a woman who starts a game that had a political purpose to it. And when you look at the career she had and how ahead of her time she was, the game winds up being the exact opposite of the message. I know we talked about this a little earlier,
but boy,
that's a little tough to take when you're looking back on her career.
Right. And I think there's a great irony there too, of course, which is I don't think many people who played Monopoly in the last few years would say, oh, that Henry George teaching tool, somehow right. That did get lost. But the fact that, you know, it's the exact opposite, I always come back to. And there was a point when I was starting to research what ended up becoming the book proposal, and I was writing about Occupy Wall Street, and I was walking around downtown in Lower Manhattan, and I saw the Mr. Monopoly iconography on signs and things. And I thought, you know, how funny is that? Mm-hmm. A century later, and here we are, you know, we've come full circle.
Well, in doing a little bit of research on the side, aside from reading the book, I was surprised to find that when it comes to Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley, Hasbro is the name of those companies today. Is that right?
Yes. So Hasbro has since acquired Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers and Cranium and a lot of other toy and game companies. And they're huge. And
it's a monopoly.
you could argue. And I have had people made that joke before, for sure. And what's really interesting about board games now is that you have things like Kickstarter, which allows somebody to put their idea out there and allow people to pay for it. So you're actually seeing, you know, for game designers, it used to be, and it's kind of like what's happening in book publishing, that you had to have one of the big game companies produce your game or you were, you know, kind of dead on arrival. But with you know, crowdfunding and the internet, I feel like game designing is having kind of this interesting renaissance where if you have an idea for something, you don't necessarily have to go through some of the larger gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, we've run out of time, but I want to tell you that this is a very enjoyable book. I urge everybody this weekend to get out their Monopoly game and play it and go buy a copy of the book, The Monopolist: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mary Pilon. Next week, Martin Ford, author of Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out more about our show, including links to past interviews and what's coming up next, at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.